On July 27th of 2015, Russian homicide detectives arrested a murder suspect thought to have killed more than 13 innocent people over the course of a decade. The full and frank account of the slayings were truly horrifying, and the Russian people were appalled by what the media told them. However, it wasn't just the grisly details of the crimes that people found so shocking, nor was it the fact that the suspect was deemed such a danger to society that they were interred in a specialist institution for the criminally insane. It was more the fact that their suspect was a grandmother in her late 60s, standing a little more than 5 feet tall. But what on earth could such an unassuming little babushka have done to be deemed such a threat to those around her? This is the story of the St. Petersburg Baba Yaga. Tamara Samsonova was born in 1947 in the city of Uzhhor, a central Russian city of around 16,000, just a few hundred miles from the Mongolian border. After finishing high school, Tamara moved to the Russian capital of Moscow, enrolling in the city's state linguistics university to study English and German. After her graduation, she was assigned a position at the state-run Interest Travel Agency in St. Petersburg and worked at the Grand Hotel Europe for more than 15 years. It was during her employment that she met her future husband, Alexei Samsonova, with a freshly married couple moving into a newly built panel house at No. 4 Dimitrov Street in 1971. To all outside observers, the couple appeared to be leading perfectly happy lives, and if there was any marital discord, they certainly did a good job of hiding it. So, when Tamara's husband mysteriously disappeared in the year 2000, she was the last person that the police considered to be a suspect. Despite law enforcement launching an extensive search for him, no trace of her husband was ever found. But Tamara didn't give up hope. She returned to the missing persons department of the St. Petersburg police many times over the years, pleading with them to find her beloved Alexei. Her efforts culminated with a visit to the investigative unit of the Fruzensky District Police, who promised that they would reopen her husband's case and work to give her the answers she'd waited more than a decade and a half for. But as they'd come to find out, Tamara was hardly the poor, innocent victim she made herself out to be, and it wasn't long before her horrendous criminal history would come to light. For several days at the end of July, a large makeshift package sat near to a pond set in a small piece parkland right on Dimitrov Street where Tamara lived. The package was noticed by several of the local residents, but illegal dumping proved to be a constant problem in the area, and it seemed everyone was too proud to clean up another's trash. So, for almost a week, whatever was wrapped in what appeared to be an opaque shower curtain remained untouched. But when a disgusting smell started to emanate from the package, someone finally decided to investigate. We often imagine Russia as being a nation gripped by permafrost, a Siberian wasteland where the citizens treat vodka like human antifreeze. But during the summer, temperatures in St. Petersburg have been known to climb as high as 100 degrees, and July of 2015 proved to be a typically sweltering summer. So, we can only imagine how well and truly gag-worthy that package must have smelled in the oppressive heat and humidity, especially when it was unwrapped to reveal a terribly decomposed set of human remains. They were so butchered and rotten that the only way possible they could identify who they belonged to was to survey the local residents to discover who was missing. But when officers knocked on the apartment door of 79-year-old Valentina Olanova, they found she wasn't home. Instead, Tamara Samsonova was living there. As it turned out, a mutual friend had asked Valentina for a small favor. Tamara was due to have work done on her home and needed a place to stay for a few weeks. Valentina was reluctant at first, but found Tamara to be a pleasant house guest who had no problem helping with housework, and after a while, Tamara became something of a nascent friend. Tamara lived in the apartment for several months, but only on the condition that she find somewhere else to stay after 3 or 4 months. However, when it came time for Tamara to find alternate lodgings, she found she had grown fond of the apartment and essentially refused to leave. Time and time again, Valentina implored Tamara to stick to her end of the bargain and leave the apartment before the relationship soured. Yet Tamara, who had been good as gold for the first 3 months, was somehow prepared to go to war with Valentina over her own apartment, and it wasn't long before the pair were fighting like cats and dogs in the small, cramped living space. After one particularly vicious argument, Tamara took a trip to a small town known as Pushkin, located on the banks of the River Neva. It was here that she purchased one of Valentina's favorite dishes, an olivier salad, a tradition of Russian cuisine that contains boiled potatoes, vegetables, eggs, and various meats in a mayonnaise dressing. One could be mistaken for thinking that this was a gift, a token of reconciliation intended to repair Tamara's broken relationship with Valentina. But the gift would prove to be anything but an olive branch, as on the very same trip, Tamara visited a small pharmacist with a very unusual request. Although she didn't have a prescription, Tamara asked the pharmacist for a packet of phenazepam pills. Developed in the Soviet Union during the mid-1970s, phenazepam is used in the treatment of various mental disorders such as psychiatric schizophrenia and anxiety. It provides a sedative effect, relieving tension and anxiety, and making the user feel calm and relaxed. It can also cause a loss of coordination, dizziness, and drowsiness. Big doses can make a user forgetful, send them to sleep, or even put them into a coma. Obviously, it's quite a powerful drug, and so at first, the pharmacist flat out refused to sell the pills to Tamara without the proper prescription. This prompted the elderly woman to beg the pharmacist, insisting that unless she received a dose soon, she would begin to suffer symptoms of paranoid schizophrenia, making her a danger to herself, as well as to those around her. This put the pharmacist in quite the predicament. Give her the pills and risk losing his job and potentially jail time, or continue to refuse her and face the dangerous consequences of her apparent condition. And so, the pharmacist gave Tamara the pills, thinking he was doing the right thing, but how wrong he was. When she returned to St. Petersburg just a few hours later, Tamara snuck into the kitchen of Valentina's apartment and began to prepare the olivier salad. We can only imagine the scene that played out afterward. A heartfelt apology, the offer of a gift, a facade of reconciliation that played out just as Tamara intended. Valentina must have dug into the salad having no idea that it was laced with obscenely high amounts of phenazepam. And as the drug began to take effect, Valentina drifted off into sleep that she would never awaken from. It was on the night of July 23, 2015, when Tamara found Valentina's unconscious body lying on the kitchen floor of her apartment. In a stand-up fight with her erstwhile flatmate, there was no guaranteeing that Tamara would win. But with her out for the count, there was nothing to stop Tamara from enacting her evil plans. She gathered up a number of household items, including steak knives, pliers, and a hacksaw, and began to brutally dismember her former housemate. It took the elderly woman a long, long time to do it, but eventually, she managed to completely saw off Valentina's head. But when she was finished, she began the arduous task of sawing off her arms and legs. This is thought to have taken the elderly Tamara days to fully complete, and that she was forced to use smaller lives to shear off pieces of Valentina's flesh so that her remains would fit into a series of small plastic bags. There were so many of these bags that it took several trips to the dumpsters before Tamara put a serious dent into the disposal of her former roommate's body, with the torso being so heavy that she was forced to simply wrap it in a shower curtain and dump it in the local pond. The job was so complex and labor-intensive that Tamara actually forgot that she left several pieces of Valentina's body just lying around the apartment. And as much as she tried to clean up the mess that she'd made, the sheer amount of gore splattered around the place was just too much work to stay on top of. Which is why, when police paid Valentina's apartment a visit in the wake of her disappearance, they found tons of evidence of her grisly handiwork. Not only did they find bloodstains in the apartment's bathroom, but the fact that the shower curtain had been torn off showed it was her who had been responsible for the torso dumped by the pond. Tamara was immediately arrested on suspicion of murder, then taken to the Frunze District Police Station for detention. 4 months later, in November of 2015, the results of a psychiatric test that Tamara had been subjected to determined that she was a dangerously insane individual. Throughout numerous interviews that sometimes lasted hours at a time, Tamara hinted at up to 13 other murders that coincided with as many unsolved missing person cases. It was even speculated that she murdered her own husband, and that her attempts to seek justice for him were little more than a bizarre form of gloating. How even when she presented herself to the authorities, they were almost incapable of considering her a suspect. Tamara had even killed the tenant she rented a room to in the wake of her husband's death. According to investigators, on September 6th of 2003, she killed her 44-year-old tenant from Norilsk after an intense argument over rent payments. She then dismembered his corpse and disposed of it on the very same street she dumped Valentina's remains. According to Russian newspapers, police found a journal in Tamara's apartment which detailed some of the murders. One entry translated from Russian to English that read, "I killed my tenant, Volodya, cut him into pieces in the bathroom with a knife, and put the pieces of his body in plastic bags and threw them away into different parts of the Fruzensky district." With this in mind, it's little wonder that Tamara felt comfortable enough to simply allow police officers into Valentina's apartment, the apartment that still bore so much evidence of her butchery. She must have felt invulnerable, having murdered in plain sight for years without being discovered. But perhaps most disturbing of all, in the process of recovering her victim's remains, police noticed that numerous internal organs had been removed from each of the bodies, the most common being the lungs. When confronted with this, Tamara made a shocking confession. She had taken to cutting out the lungs, liver, and kidneys of her victims, then strewing or frying them to be served as traditional Russian dishes. Tamara supposedly said it was delicious and a nutritious way to save money. What's more, Tamara's neighbor of 15 years, Marina Kravenko, said that Tamara was obsessed with black magic and very interested in the maniac Chikatilo, a reference to the infamous Soviet serial killer Andrei Chikatilo. Chikatilo was the USSR's most prolific serial killer, one that was said not to exist because there couldn't possibly be murder in the workers' paradise that was the Soviet Union. The self-described vampire indecently assaulted, murdered, and cannibalized up to 52 people in the space of a decade, and reportedly enjoyed chopping out his victims' tongues, bursting their eardrums, and gouging out their eyes. These details awakened a morbid fascination in Tamara, apparently inspiring her to commit similar acts of terror. Tamara's story is yet another case of a killer hiding in plain sight, taunting authorities with hints of their own guilt. We could even speculate that Tamara actually wanted to be caught, how only one last thing separated her from her beloved Andrei Chikatilo, the pure infamy of being known as one of Russia's vilest, most prolific serial killers. In December of 1927, detectives of the Los Angeles Police Department received a missing persons report for 12-year-old Marion Parker. She had vanished from the Mount Vernon Junior High School in the Lafayette Square section of LA after being excused from class, with her teacher saying that a coworker of Marion's father had arrived to collect her. According to him, Perry Parker had been involved in a car accident and had summoned his family from his hospital bed, fearing it might be his last opportunity to see them. Naturally, Marion's teacher understood the severity of such a grim situation and immediately excused her from class. This teacher, Mary Holt, later claimed that she never would have let Marion go but for the apparent sincerity and disarming manner of the man. Yet there's one little detail that this teacher appears to have overlooked, and that's how Marion had a twin sister in the same school, one that her father's co-workers seemed to have completely ignored. The very next day, her family filed a missing persons report, with her father claiming no knowledge of a car accident or his mysterious co-worker. The day after Marion's disappearance, a telegram was delivered to the Parker family home. The letter stated that Marion had been kidnapped and would only be returned unharmed if a ransom of $1,500 was paid using a series of $20 gold certificates. As proof of life, they included what was quite clearly Marion's handwriting, with the additional message of, "Do positively nothing till you receive special delivery letter." In those days, there was a small section of the telegram that stated who had sent it, and in this case, the author had signed their name as simply, Death. Missing persons detectives got to work trying to pin down where the telegram had been sent from, while Perry Parker began putting together the ransom. But as they busied themselves with the task of saving Marion's life, another telegram was delivered, apparently having been sent from nearby Pasadena. "Marion is secure. Use good judgment. Interference with my plans is dangerous." This telegram was signed, "The Fox," with the timing and content suggesting that Marion's kidnapper was watching the Parkers' every move from somewhere uncomfortably close by. Later that day, the Parkers received yet another telegram, warning that no one will ever see the girl again except the angels in heaven. This one was signed with the word, "Bait." The obvious warning set Perry Parker into overdrive, and by that evening, he had not only collected the full ransom amount, he had also managed to arrange a time and location for an exchange. However, it seems that his daughter's kidnapper was well aware of his attempt to coordinate with police and recognized the supposed exchange as the trap that it was. Perry waited at the arranged location for several hours, with missing persons detectives observing from a concealed vantage point nearby. The kidnapper didn't show. The next morning, the Parkers received a telegram in which the kidnapper's tone had radically shifted. They had signed the note with the word Thanatos, which one investigator recognized as the Greek word for death. The attached message was from a furious kidnapper, outraged that Perry had not only been in contact with the national press, but had also tried to snare him in what was quite obviously a sting operation. According to the kidnapper, it was their final day to exchange the gold certificates for their daughter. Failure to do so would result in her execution. The telegram also included a handwritten note, clearly written by the terrified young Marion, in which she begged her father to give in to the kidnapper's demands and to eschew any further police involvement. An enjoined message from the kidnapper told Perry, "Recover your senses. I want your money rather than to kill your child. But so far you have given me no other alternative. Fox is my name. Very sly, you know. Set no traps. I'll watch for them. Get this straight. Remember that life hangs by a thread. I have a Gillette ready and am able to handle the situation." After an emotionally tumultuous meeting with the presiding missing persons detectives, Perry Parker was given permission to meet with the kidnapper alone, without a contingent of police, so that he might try one last time to save his daughter's life. That evening, Perry Parker was contacted by the kidnapper via telephone, and the pair arranged a new meeting place with an assurance that no police officers would be in attendance. They agreed on the location being the corner of West 5th Street and South Manhattan Place in central Los Angeles. Then, around 7:15 in the evening, the kidnapper gave Perry the signal to drive out to the corner, telling him they knew which car he would be driving and which direction he would be approaching from. Further evidence that he was being closely observed, and possibly by more than one kidnapper. 45 minutes later, Perry arrived at the prearranged meeting place and was almost immediately accosted by a masked man armed with a sawed-off shotgun. Driving a Chrysler coupe, the masked man revealed himself as the kidnapper and pointed to Marion in the back seat before demanding Perry hand over the ransom money. The girl's father could see her in the back seat. Her eyes were wide open, but she wasn't moving. He called out to her, but she didn't respond. She just stared straight ahead, her mouth slightly agape, with a hauntingly peculiar expression on her face. The kidnapper assured Perry that his daughter had been drugged, lest she cause a scene, but was otherwise unharmed. When he handed over the package containing the ransom money, the kidnapper shoved Marion's body out of the car as he remarked, "There's your daughter." Then he cranked the vehicle into gear, put his foot down, and raced away from the scene. It should have been a relatively happy occasion, at least one in which a degree of relief was experienced. but there was something about the way his daughter's body had slumped out of the passenger seat, something about the way she lay motionless on the road in front of him. When he kneeled down to take her hand, Perry found Marion's flesh was stone cold. But that wasn't all. Her eyes were being held open with piano wire. The sleeves of her blouse were empty as her arms and legs had been cut off, and after being disemboweled, whoever killed her had stuffed her abdominal cavity with a shirt and a towel. It was a living nightmare. No parent should have to see the lifeless corpse of their own child, but the horror of seeing it so horrifically mutilated is almost too much to comprehend. At 9 p.m. that night, Marion's body was taken for an autopsy. A coroner determined that she had been dead for around 12 hours, and that her killer had simply kept up the pretense of the kidnapping so he could get the ransom money too. Yet given the brutal nature of her killing, there's every chance that murdering her was the primary intention of her kidnapping, and that the ransom was just a depraved method of taunting her surviving family members. The following morning, a gentleman on a morning walk found a set of severed child's limbs in the Elysian Park. Each was wrapped in a piece of newspaper and appeared to have simply been tossed around randomly in plain sight so that some unfortunate soul might stumble across them. The murder was huge news all over the country. People were outraged, and rightly so. As a result, a huge manhunt for Marion's murderer commenced, involving over 20,000 police officers and local volunteers. Thanks to thousands of monetary contributions from the horrified general public, a reward of $100,000 was offered for information leading to the kidnapper's capture, the equivalent today of more than $1.4 million. Thanks to the massive search effort, investigators quickly found an abandoned getaway vehicle used by Marion's killer, identifying it as one stolen from San Diego just a short while previously. Fingerprints were taken from the door handle of the vehicle, but they matched none in the existing database. Police considered several suspects at first, including the son of a local dentist, but were cleared of suspicion after Mary Holt, the teacher who had spoken with Marion's abductor, confirmed none were her kidnapper. Investigators then managed to trace a laundry mark on the towel found stuffed inside Marion's torso to the Bellevue Arms apartments, where they interviewed a number of tenants. Then on December 20th, the fingerprints taken from the abandoned getaway vehicle were identified as belonging to William Edward Hickman, who was actually a former co-worker of Perry Parker. Both men were employed by the First National Bank of Los Angeles, where Parker worked as an assistant cashier and Hickman as an officer. The previous year, Hickman had been arrested on a complaint made by Perry regarding stolen and forged checks totaling $400, and as a result, was convicted and sentenced to probation. Additional fingerprints lifted from the ransom letters were able to be positively identified as Hickman's. It was subsequently uncovered that Hickman had been a new resident of the Bellevue Arms, having moved into the building recently under the alias Donald Evans, after spending 6 months out in Kansas with family. It became horrifyingly clear that Hickman had left town after his conviction, may well have been plotting his terrible revenge the whole time. When detectives examined Hickman's apartment, evidence of his guilt was clear. Bloody fingerprints were found, along with partly burnt handwritten drafts of ransom letters and newspaper clippings which detailed Marion's kidnapping. Just 2 days after the abandoned getaway car was found, an Oregon police officer recognized Hickman from a wanted poster, and after a brief but intense pursuit, Hickman was arrested in possession of around $1,400 worth of the gold ransom. At first, Hickman admitted involvement in the kidnapping, but claimed he was a small part of a larger team, and that someone else was responsible for murdering Marion. During an extensive interview with a journalist from the East Oregonian, Hickman implicated two other men, Oliver and Frank Kramer, as the brothers who carried out the murder. However, an extensive investigation by homicide detectives had determined that this was impossible, as the Kramer brothers had been incarcerated for several months on other charges. Not only that, but given that Hickman had prior knowledge of the Kramer criminal history, it's safe to assume that blaming the two men was just another part of his intricate plan for revenge. Police told Hickman the game was up. They knew everything, and his only chance at avoiding the hangman's noose would be to make a full confession. At that, Hickman broke down, admitting to strangling Marion while she was blindfolded and tied to a chair. He proceeded to hang Parker's body upside down in his bathtub, slicing her throat at the jugular vein to drain the body of blood. After disarticulating her arms and legs, he proceeded to disembowel her, during which he stated the body jerked with such force that it flew out of the tub, suggesting that she may have still been alive during the dismemberment. Hickman then wrapped Parker's limbs in newspaper before temporarily storing her torso in a suitcase. He then left the apartment, attempting to distract himself by watching a movie at the nearby Lowe's State Theater. But unsurprisingly, he was unable to focus on anything but the atrocious act he'd just committed. And after bawling his eyes out in the dark movie theater, Hickman came up with a plan to, as he put it, make things right. He realized that Perry Parker would probably want to see his daughter one last time, before she was gone forever. With that in mind, he set about the grim process of reconstructing her butchered body, pinning her eyes open with wire, and even applying makeup to her face. Reflecting on the entire ordeal, Hickman told police that Marion felt perfectly safe and the tragedy was so sudden and unexpected that I'm sure she never actually suffered through the whole affair, except for a little sobbing which she couldn't keep back for her father and mother. We can only marvel at the twisted logic that Hickman employs here, believing having subjected a small child to the most terrifying ordeal of her short life, he claims she didn't suffer. At his trial, Hickman tried to further distance himself from responsibility by claiming he was severely mentally ill. Hickman told his attorneys that he had killed Parker upon the direction of a supernatural deity he called Providence, a claim that was echoed by Hickman's defense attorney, openly labeled his client as criminally insane and not responsible for his own actions. The attorney explained that Hickman was mentally ill and deeply influenced by his religious zealot grandfather during his youth. He was said to have frequently been exposed to frenzied religious exorcisms out of the limbo of his subconscious mind, subcharged with severe repressions of his awful childhood, homicide and mutilation ideated. However, the jury saw through the elaborate charade and recognized Hickman as the vicious, vengeful, and evil man that he was. And after they found him guilty, Hickman was sentenced to death by hanging. During his final months, Hickman reportedly embraced Roman Catholicism and wrote letters of apology to his victim's family, but it's more than likely that this was just another attempt to aid his appeal, and that he was only truly sorry that he was condemned to die. On October 19, 1928, William Edward Hickman was hanged on the gallows in the San Quentin prison. Upon falling through the trap doors of the gallows, Hickman struck his head and began violently twitching and jerking. According to witnesses, it took approximately 2 minutes for Hickman to die. An autopsy performed after his execution showed that Hickman's neck did not break during the hanging and that he had died from asphyxia. Some suggested divine intervention, pointing out the bittersweet irony of Hickman dying in the same way that Marion had. But this is merely a cold comfort, for as much as Hickman saw justice for his crimes, he was still able to wreak a terrible suffering in the years he was alive. And no amount of his suffering would ever bring Marion back to her family. On February 8th of 1983, a Dino Rod employee named Michael Catran paid a visit to Cranley Gardens in London. Several complaints had been made by the tenants of an apartment block that their plumbing wasn't functioning correctly, and it was Catran's job to identify the source of the problem before unblocking the relevant pipes. When he opened a drain cover at the side of the house, Catran discovered the drain was packed with a flesh-like substance and numerous small bones that could have easily come from a chicken. "It looks to me like someone had been flushing down their Kentucky Fried Chicken," Catran told his supervisor, who agreed to join him on a visit to the property the following morning to discuss how to unclog such a serious blockage. Yet the next morning, the two men found the drain had been completely cleared. It had been a hefty job, and it was unlikely one that could have been completed overnight, given the amount of noise and work required. The suspicion of both men was immediately aroused, and they completely took apart the exterior drainage pipe to make sure none of the strange substance remained. Katran discovered some scraps of flesh and four bones in a pipe leading from the drain which linked to the top flat of the house, and to their horror, both Katran and Wheeler observed that the bones looked like those found in human fingers. They immediately contacted the police who, upon further inspection, discovered further small bones and scraps of what looked to the naked eye like either human or animal flesh in the same pipe. These remains were taken to a coroner, who deduced that the remains were human. Homicide detectives then staked out the apartment from which the fleshy remains were coming from, approaching a man when he returned home and attempted to enter. Detective Chief Inspector Peter J. introduced himself and his colleagues, explaining they had come to inquire about the blockage in the drains from his flat. Nilsson asked why police were interested in his drains and also whether the two officers present with Jay were health inspectors. In response, Jay informed Nilsson that the other two were also police officers and requested access to his flat to discuss the matter further. Upon entry, the three detectives were almost overwhelmed by the overpowering odor of rotting flesh. When informed of the situation, the tenant appeared to be shocked and confused, stating, "Good grief, how awful." But the police weren't fooled by the man's attempt at a ruse, and demanded he tell them why human flesh had been found in his drainage pipe. Nilsson went on to calmly admit that the remainder of his victims could be found in two plastic bags in a nearby wardrobe. When asked if there were any other victims, the man responded, "It's a long story. It goes back a long time. I'll tell you everything. I want to get it off my chest. Not here, at the police station." He was then arrested on suspicion of murder before being taken to Hornsey Police Station. As he was escorted to the police station, Nilsson was asked whether the remains in his flat belonged to one person or two. Staring out of the window of the police car, he replied, 15 or 16, since 1978. That evening, Detective Chief Inspector Jay led a forensic team to Cranley Gardens, where the plastic bags were removed from the wardrobe and taken to Hornsey Mortuary. One bag was found to contain two dissected torsos, one of which had been vertically dissected, and a shopping bag containing various internal organs. The second bag contained a human skull almost completely devoid of flesh, a severed head, and a torso with arms attached but hands missing. Both of the heads were found to have deliberately been subjected to moist heat and were horribly decomposed as a result. In an interview conducted shortly after their arrest, the suspect confessed there were further human remains stowed in a tea chest in his living room, with other remains inside an upturned drawer in his bathroom. They confessed to dozens of other murders, attempted murders, and assaults, and responded to one particular question with an answer that chilled the investigating detectives to the bone. When asked why he had killed in so much, the man responded, "I was hoping you could tell me that." The man was Dennis Nilsson, one of the most prolific and sadistic serial killers in British history. Dennis Nilsson was born on November 23, 1945, in Aberdeenshire, Scotland. Dennis was a quiet but adventurous child. Some of his earliest childhood memories were of family picnics in the Scottish countryside with his mother and siblings, and of his grandparents' strict religious lifestyle. In what Nilsson later described as his most vivid childhood recollection, his weeping mother asked him whether he wanted to see his grandfather. He was then taken into the room where his grandfather lay dead in an open coffin. As Nilsson gazed upon the body, his mother told him his grandfather was sleeping and that he'd gone to a better place. In the years following the death of his grandfather, Nilsson became quieter and more withdrawn, often standing alone at the harbor watching the herring boats. At home, he rarely took part in family activities and shunned any attempts by adult family members to show him any affection. By late 1978, Nilsson had moved to London and was living a solitary existence. He had three failed relationships under his belt, and his self-esteem was in the toilet. Throughout that year, he became something of a workaholic and spent most of his spare time alone, either drinking or listening to music. Then on December 30th of 1978, Dennis was in a Cricklewood Arms pub when he observed a rather youthful-looking gentleman attempting to purchase alcohol. The bartender instantly recognized his potential patron as being underage and told him to bugger off. But on his way out of the door, the 14-year-old felt someone tapping on his shoulder. It was Dennis, and he presented the young man with a promising offer. He could drink all the beer and vodka he wanted, but he had to spend the night with him. The young man obliged, and the two drank late into the night before passing out, fully clothed, I might add, on Dennis's bed. Dennis later said that the next morning he was afraid to wake his sleeping companion in case he became embarrassed and left. After caressing the sleeping youth, Nilsson decided the young man was to stay with him over the new year whether he wanted to or not. He retrieved a necktie from his closet, wrapped it around the young man's neck, and strangled him into unconsciousness. Once he was incapacitated, Dennis finished him off by drowning him in a bucket filled with water. Once the job was done, Dennis washed the body in his bathtub before placing the boy on his bed. What he did next is better left unsaid, but the boy's corpse remained beneath the floorboards for almost 8 months before Dennis built a bonfire in the garden behind his flat and burned the body in the summer of the following year. Dennis later said, "I eased him into his new bed, but about a week later, I wondered whether his body had changed at all or had started to decompose. I disinterred him and pulled the dirt-stained youth up onto the floor. His skin was very dirty. I stripped myself naked and carried him into the bedroom and washed the body. There was practically no discoloration and his skin was pale white. His limbs were more relaxed than when I had put him down there. I caused dreams, which caused death. This is my crime. I had started down the avenue of death in possession of a new kind of flatmate." Almost a year later, on December 3rd of 1979, Nilsson met a 23-year-old Canadian student named Kenneth Ockenden, who had been on a tour of England visiting relatives. Dennis bumped into the young Kenneth in a West End pub. Upon learning he was a tourist, Dennis offered to take him sightseeing, an offer which Kenneth warmly accepted. Dennis then invited the young man to his home on the promise of some food and more alcohol. Dennis showed Kenneth his record player and the expensive surround sound headphones he used to listen to music. Kenneth gave them a try, and with his senses muffled by the drink and the loud music, Dennis ambushed him by wrapping the headphone wire around his neck before he began to strangle him. Dennis recalled dragging the youth across his floor with the wire wrapped around his neck as he strangled him, before pouring himself half a glass of rum and continuing to listen to music. The next day, Dennis purchased a Polaroid camera and photographed Kenneth's body in various erotic positions. He then laid his victim's corpse on top of himself while lying on his bed, keeping it there as he watched television for several hours before wrapping the body in plastic bags and stowing the corpse beneath the floorboards. On approximately 4 occasions over the few weeks that followed, Dennis removed Kenneth's body from beneath his floorboards and seated the body upon his armchair alongside him as he watched his favorite TV shows and drank rum or beer. Nilsson continued to kill over the years, and with some highly disturbing results. After murdering another unidentified victim, Nilsson had a fit of remorse and unsuccessfully attempted to revive the victim before sinking to his knees and sobbing. He then stood up, looked at himself in the mirror and began cursing himself out, spitting in his own image while he scolded himself for lacking self-control. He then said he picked up the dead body and lay alongside it in the bed as he listened to a piece of classical music called Fanfare for the Common Man. As the piece of music climaxed, Dennis burst into tears and caressed the corpse's face as if in apology, before he stowed the corpse beneath the floorboards. Eventually, there were so many corpses interred beneath Dennis's floorboards that he began to attract insects and let off a truly eye-watering, awful stench. On occasions when Nilsson disinterred victims from beneath the floorboards, he noticed that the bodies were covered with pupae and infested with maggots. Some victims' heads had maggots crawling out of eye sockets and mouths. He placed deodorants beneath the floorboards and sprayed insecticide about the flat twice daily, but the odor of decay and the presence of flies remained. Nielsen was brought to trial in October of 1983, charged with 6 counts of murder and 2 of attempted murder. The prosecution called a psychiatrist who testified that, through a lack of emotional development, Nielsen experienced difficulty expressing any emotion other than anger, and had a tendency to treat other human beings as components of his fantasies. The psychiatrist also described Nielsen's association between unconscious bodies and arousal, stating that Nielsen possessed narcissistic traits, an impaired sense of identity, and was able to depersonalize other people. His conclusion was that Nielsen displayed many signs of maladaptive behavior, a truly lethal combination in his opinion. As a result of the grisly evidence presented, a jury unanimously convicted Dennis on 6 counts of murder, with the judge sentencing him to life imprisonment with the recommendation that he serve a minimum of 25 years. His imprisonment would end years of manipulation, slaughter, and shame from a man who was simply unequipped to deal with his unconventional desires. And although Dennis was safely away from the public he preyed upon, the legacy of his horrifying works would live on for years to come. On October 26th of 1965, police detectives arrived at 3850 East New York Street in Indianapolis after being summoned by the terrified homeowner. When they arrived, a woman named Gertrude Benijewski led the detectives into a bedroom where on a filthy, stained mattress lay the half-starved, horribly beaten, and extensively mutilated body of 16-year-old Sylvia Marie Likens. Clinging to a copy of the Bible, Gertrude's sisters said something that made the detectives extremely suspicious. She pointed to Sylvia's body and said that her death was meant to happen, which might have seemed like a touch of religious fatalism, but left a bad taste in the detectives' mouths as they tried to establish exactly what had happened. According to Gertrude, the teenage girl had left the house earlier that week, having tried to run away from home with a group of local boys, but had returned earlier that day having been brutally assaulted and had passed away shortly afterward. When asked, Sylvia's sister confirmed the older woman's stories, stating that her sister had disappeared, then reappeared, bearing the horrendous wounds. However, when the young girl had a moment alone with detectives, she lowered a voice and whispered, "Get me out of here. I'll tell you everything." Down at the precinct, young Jenny Likens told the story of how she and her sister lived with their parents, but were forced to board with the Benijewski family whenever their carnival worker parents were on the road. They could sometimes be on the road for months at a time, and so the girl's father, Lester, agreed to pay the Benijewskis a $20 per week boarding fee for looking after their daughters. Gertrude, in particular, assured him that the girls would be treated as if though they were her own, and that he hadn't anything to worry about. And for a while, this was true. Gertrude made the girls help out with household chores, but was otherwise perfectly friendly to the two girls. However, after a few weeks, the $20 boarding fee began to arrive later and later. In response, Gertrude began taking out her frustration upon the sisters, beating them with various instruments while making statements such as, "Well, I took care of you two little wenches for a week for nothing." By August of that year, Gertrude had begun to focus all of her abuse exclusively upon Sylvia, most likely being jealous of her physical appearance and potential in life. Such abuse included beatings and deliberate starvation, with Gertrude often forcing Sylvia to eat leftovers or spoiled food out of garbage cans. And in one incident of extreme gaslighting, Sylvia was accused of stealing candy she had actually purchased with her spending money. On another occasion, as the Benijewskis ate dinner, they force-fed Sylvia a hot dog overloaded with condiments including mustard, ketchup, and spices. The food was so spicy and rich that she later vomited up the meal, only to have Gertrude force her to re-eat what she had thrown up. The Benijewskis turned their abuse of Sylvia into something of an enterprise and charged local children 5 cents apiece to humiliate beat, and mutilate the poor girl. In one incident, a gang of paying teenagers helped Gertrude submerge Sylvia in a bath of boiling water before they rubbed salt into the burns. In another, a 14-year-old neighbor of the Benijewskis named Richard Dean Hobbs was allowed to tattoo the phrase, "I'm a prostitute and proud of it," onto Sylvia's stomach with a heated needle. The following day, Gertrude forced her to write a letter to her parents, stating that the wounds she had received were not from the Benijewskis, but from a gang of local criminals who'd grabbed her after an escape attempt. Satisfied that she'd absolved herself of any guilt, Gertrude hatched a plan to leave Sylvia to die in some woods nearby. But before she could do so, Sylvia's condition began to rapidly deteriorate. By the morning of October 26th, Sylvia had been tortured so brutally and routinely that she was unable to walk or talk properly. She seemed brain dead. Some of her sores were dangerously infected. Sylvia looked and acted more like an extra in a zombie movie than a 16-year-old girl. When Gertrude tried to feed her a donut and a glass of milk, she found Sylvia was incapable of chewing or swallowing, and dragging her back to the basement in frustration. It was then that Sylvia became delirious, moaning and mumbling, apparently in a world of her own. When Gertrude told her to snap out of it, slapping Sylvia across the face, the young girl responded by giggling and defecating on herself. The Benijewskis, beginning to worry that Sylvia was beyond repair, gathered in the basement to discuss what to do with her. To their horror, Sylvia began jerking her arms in their direction as if trying to point at them before saying things like, You're Ricky. The 16-year-old talked as if she were a child, suggesting severe brain damage had been inflicted during one of her beatings. "Shut up. Shut up," Gertrude exploded in response. "You know who I am." One of the family tried to feed Sylvia a rotten pear, only to find her teeth broke when she tried to bite into it. When the family turned to exit the basement, Sylvia weakly attempted to follow. Gertrude responded by shoving her to the floor and stamping on her head. The results of their prolonged torture broke some of the younger members of the Benijewski family, who, despite being willing to subject the poor Sylvia to hellish levels of torment and abuse, were incapable of dealing with the results of their actions. Gertrude's daughter, Stephanie, assisted Richard Hobbs in bathing and dressing what remained of young Sylvia, and lay her on one of the comfortable upstairs beds. It's then that Sylvia uttered her final words. "I wish Daddy was here." When Stephanie realized that Sylvia was no longer breathing, she attempted CPR to revive her. Richard rushed to fetch Gertrude, telling her that Sylvia had died. But Gertrude barked out that her recently deceased charge was simply faking it, and beat Sylvia's corpse with a book, shouting, "Faker, faker." But when she too realized that Sylvia was dead, she panicked and ordered Richard Hobbs to call 911 while she prepared the scene. She wiped down Sylvia's corpse with rubbing alcohol, dressed and covered her wounds, and applied makeup to her face to conceal the heavy amount of bruising. She stuffed Sylvia's lifeless hand with the letter she had been forced to write, assuming it would misdirect the investigating detectives, then simply waited for them to arrive. By the time little Jenny Jenkins had finished telling the story of her sister's death, the detectives who questioned her were beyond horrified. They immediately drove back to the Benijewskis' house, arresting Gertrude and several of her children, including the neighbor boy Richard Hobbs. Faced with the severity of her crimes, Gertrude Benijewski failed to show an ounce of remorse and signed a statement admitting having repeatedly beaten Sylvia about the backside with her belt. She also admitted to once punching Sylvia so hard that she broke her own wrist. The official cause of Sylvia's death was listed as a brain bleed resulting from severe blows to her right temple, which obviously implicated Gertrude as her murderer. Sylvia had received many wounds over the past few months, but one and one alone killed her, that sickening stamp to the head on the day she died. At her trial on May 19, 1966, a jury found Gertrude Benijewski guilty of first-degree murder, with various children of hers being found guilty of second-degree murder and manslaughter. Upon hearing the verdicts, Gertrude and her children burst into tears and attempted to console each other. Of all the horrendous details that are freely available to the public regarding the torture and murder of Sylvia Likens, This is perhaps one of the most disturbing. How in the world could such a family, who had literally subjected another human being to a living hell before stealing her life away, possibly feel that they deserved any kind of leniency or forgiveness? They were monsters, truly evil. A family who were trusted to take care of Lester Lycan's most precious worldly possessions, his own flesh and blood, and chose to do the polar opposite. On the morning of February 30th in the year 2000, neighbors of Australian miner John Price noticed that his car was still in the driveway. This was highly unusual as John's shift began very early in the morning, and he only rarely took days off. His employer also noted how strange this was, and since he hadn't been in touch to inform them of his absence, his bosses were so concerned that they actually sent one of the miners over to John's house to check if he was okay. At first, this employee knocked on John's bedroom window, but after moving towards the front door, he noticed that there was blood on the handle. Shortly afterward, uniformed officers broke down the door to John's home to find one of the most horrific crime scenes in Australian criminal history, and immediately called in homicide detectives to get to grips with the carnage. On arrival, detectives discovered that John had been stabbed almost 40 different times, with many of the wounds extending into vital organs. Whoever had killed John had then skinned him, then hung the skin from a meat hook near the TV lounge. His killer then took to butchering his corpse, chopping out sections of his thighs and lower back before apparently cooking up the meat with baked potato, pumpkin, beetroot, zucchini, cabbage, yellow squash, and gravy. John's head was found in a pot with vegetables that were actually still warm, indicating that the cooking had taken place in the early morning. This meat was then served up as part of two different meals which sat on the dinner table nearby. This dinner table had been properly set, with each plate bearing the names of John's children, as if his killer had intended for his own kids to eat their father's remains. A third meal was thrown on the back lawn for unknown reasons, although it is speculated that his killer had tried and failed to eat it. His killer was discovered to be 45-year-old Catherine Mary Knight, John's romantic partner who was asleep in the house at the time he was discovered. In the years prior to the murder, Catherine and John had argued over his refusal to marry her. In retaliation, she videotaped items he had allegedly stolen from work and sent the tape to his boss. Although the items were out-of-date medical kits that he had scavenged from the company trash bin, Price was fired from the job he had held for 17 years. As a result of her betrayal, he kicked her out of his home. But a few months later, Price inexplicably restarted the relationship, although he now tried to re-establish some serious boundaries. Yet despite John's attempts at de-escalation, the fighting became even more frequent, and most of his friends would no longer have anything to do with him while they remained together. The relationship culminated in Catherine stabbing her lover while he slept. But despite entering a guilty plea at her trial, Catherine has always denied full responsibility for the murder, blaming mental illness and disassociation for her ability to kill someone she claimed to love so much. But it seems the truth is far, far darker than that. Catherine Knight is a woman who decided that if she couldn't have John Price to herself, she would wreak a terrible revenge on him and his family. It wasn't enough to simply murder her lover. She wanted his children to live with the knowledge that they ate the flesh of their own dead father. Hey friends, thanks for listening. Click that notification bell to be alerted of all future narrations. I release every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And if you got a story, be sure to submit them to my subreddit, r/letsreadofficial, and maybe even hear your story featured on the next video. And join a live stream on random Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Sundays. And if you want to support me even more, grab early access to all future narrations for just $1 a month on Patreon, and maybe even pick up some Let's Read merch on Spreadshirt. And check out the Let's Read podcast, where you can hear all these stories in long compilation form and save huge on data, located anywhere you listen to podcasts. Links in the bio. Thanks so much, friends, and I'll see you again soon.